climate emergency and the need to reach net zero emissions by 2050 has been brought into sharp focus over the past 12 months, with numerous extreme weather events and the recent COP26 conference in Glasgow. Now, this enormous challenge can only be tackled if governments, businesses, and civil society work together to take ambitious action. My name is Marije Groen, and in this podcast, I'll talk with Pauline Grange and Natasha Ebtehaj about the four key climate change themes that they think will be prominent over the next few years, and of course, the impact it will have on their role as stewards of capital. Pauline is portfolio manager at Columbia Threadneedle Investments. She manages the Global Sustainable Outcomes Strategy, which aims to combine financial results and sustainable outcomes. Natasha Ebtehaj is Portfolio Manager Global Equities at Columbia Threadneedle Investments. Welcome both Pauline and Natasha. Wonderful to have you both.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for being here. We're actually going to be talking about four key climate themes. And just for the listeners, so they know what they can expect, I'll discuss the first three with Pauline. And then Natasha, you'll be back with us at the end of the interview when we start the fourth theme on biodiversity. So great to have you both. Pauline, maybe let's start off with you. What makes these four key climate themes so compelling in your view?
It's simple, really. I mean, it's just the huge amount of investment which is going to come over the next several decades to deliver on these themes. And so that offers great growth and return opportunities, both from a corporate and an investor level, but at the same time is really, you know, helps the planet, helps address these huge challenges we are facing.
Right. So shall we just kick it off and start off with the first key theme?
Great, yeah.
Wonderful. Well, the first key theme is challenges and opportunities of a transition to net zero. So European energy markets have been hitting the headlines in 2021 with rocketing electricity costs and escalating geopolitical tensions. And as we are entering this energy transition, it's becoming increasingly clear that we are in for a bumpy ride, with supply and demand for fossil fuels becoming increasingly difficult to predict. Sparks are sure to fly in energy markets. Pauline, what lessons from 2021 on the energy transition are important for 2022 and beyond?
I think the key lesson is it's very easy to set these big net zero targets, but the reality of transitioning from this very long-term addiction we've had on fossil fuels is going to be complex, a lot more complex and tougher once we embark on it. If you look at the recent energy crisis, at its core was just really this big mismatch between supply and demand for fossil fuels. As we increase the use of renewable and variable renewable energy in our grid, it's very difficult to predict and match that. So we saw here in Europe and UK, the wind doesn't always blow. The last 3 months, we've had no wind.
Right.
It's looking good based on my recent dog walks. The wind's blowing again. But, we didn't have that. And then in Latin America, there have been severe droughts there. They're very reliant on hydropower. And that's dropped significantly. And so you're seeing all these regions now having to drive up their consumption of natural gas, which provides that reliability to the grid. Mm-hmm. At the same time, we've been cutting our investments in fossil fuels. That's dropped about 40% since 2015. And plus we've had near-term COVID challenges. So you've had this big mismatch and the subsequent squeeze. It's not the first time we've had these big transitions. I like to use the example of the whale oil industry. Mm. We in the mid-19th century, we went from using whale oil to petroleum, which we now use in coal. And that transition was also inflationary and difficult. And in the near term, in the medium term of that transition, the whale oil price spiked. So we have been here before, and it doesn't mean that we won't be successful in ultimately moving to this superior new energy technology.
Right. Now, the theme of energy transition is really very broad. And perhaps instead we could focus on the power of the sector and the outlook for growth and competitiveness for renewable energy and storage technology as the energy transition is gaining momentum.
So, I mean, what this crisis is really highlighting and what we believe is going to happen is just this acceleration in investment in renewable energy. And we need to not only invest in, say, the green power generation, but also the technology needed to make it more reliable. So that's the battery storage as well as hydrogen side of the equation. We also need to be better at planning. So when this renewable energy enters the grid and exceeds more than 30%, we've got to be better at planning for that. And it's also understanding the role of that transition fuels are going to play in this transition. So natural gas in the near term, but also nuclear has a role over the long term in providing that reliability. And so when we look at the sort of opportunities, is we just see this huge wave of investment coming. And so we're estimating, you know, it is estimated the investment needed in energy supply and infrastructure is going to amount to between $92 trillion and $173 trillion over the next 30 years, the next three decades. And so that's huge upfront investments. And at the same time, you know, renewable energy is going to take this increasing share of the power sector, but you're also going to see a surge in electricity demand as we electrify our economies. So we shift to electric vehicles and mobility. We electrify our buildings, shift from gas to heat, electric heating. We electrify industries. We shift from fossil fuels in our supply chain. There's multiple examples. So here we see opportunities in some of the big renewable utility providers, which have been a bit lackluster this year. But long term, we just see, you know, the investment wave that is coming. An example there, we have an investment in the biggest renewable investor globally, NextEra, in the US. And they have very strong technology and attach rates and battery as well, which provides reliability to their grid. There's opportunities across the industrial sector who are exposed to the investment in the grid and charging networks, as well as in battery storage, which is necessary to provide that reliability.
You touched upon that topic of electronic vehicles just now, Pauline, and that's actually a climate key theme number two. Electric vehicles, or EVs as they are called, are an important part of meeting global goals on climate change. And although EVs only have a 2% market share currently, experts do believe that the market share will skyrocket in the coming years. The electronic car market represents a huge investment opportunity, but also contains some Wild West elements, so to speak. So I understand, Pauline, that you believe that we are on the cusp of a J-curve inflection in EV demand. What exactly does that mean from an investor's perspective?
So I'd say, you know, in parts of the world, we're actually on that J-curve now. So we're seeing that in China, and particularly this year, it's really surprised to the upside in EV adoption. And there, their EV sales penetration of total sales in August hit 17%. And so if you look at what's behind that, it's really, you know, first and foremost, the cost of EVs is falling. So there's a number of sort of electric vehicle startups there, like NIO, XPeng. You've had Tesla with their Model Y coming out, with their new models coming out. And so the cost is now moving, falling enough that it's hitting that upper mass market entry premium sector. And at the end of the day, they're a lot lower operating costs in running these cars. And then also battery performance has improved. And that helps to solve some of this so-called range anxiety that that buyers have. But also what's important to note in China, what's been behind this inflection, the number two reason cited for adoption is just the better driving experience. And I just got an electric vehicle, and I like to use the analogy that it's like me moving from my Nokia brick phone to an iPhone.
Oh, really?
When the iPhone
wow.
came out.
Yeah.
It's you know, the digital content is phenomenal. Mm. It's a great driving experience. And so China is clearly on its way, and there it's expected that they're approaching cost parity with combustion engines. And that's really where the market inflects at that point. Europe's been strong, but perhaps a bit disappointing this year. And that's perhaps more around supply chain shortages. Very hard to get hold of any electric vehicle here in the UK. But in the US, which has been a clear laggard, where demand has been lackluster, we think they're about to start inflecting from 2022. And that's really going to push global demand. And that's a combination of the Biden government really now progressively pursuing this. They're investing in charging network. They're offering rebates and tax incentives. And also Americans like big cars. And there's some big pickup trucks coming, some SUVs, and that's very important for that market. And so from an investment perspective, we've had these big technological J-curves, these disruptive technologies. And what you've seen time and time again is humans and investors, we're all humans, underestimate the speed at which this happens. And that in turn throws up great investment opportunities for us.
Right. You touched upon Biden's tactics already. A big driver of growth is government support, indeed. Do you expect governments to continue to subsidize the EV market, Pauline?
So I think, you know, subsidies obviously play a very vital role in driving adoption of new technologies. So we saw that in renewables. So we saw that with solar and in wind. And they were important. But now we've hit in solar and wind, the huge price falls in that sector where they're no longer that important. And so we expect the same to happen in electric vehicles. As the industry scales, as the technology improves, we will reach a point where those subsidies and those incentives will no longer be necessary. And as I mentioned, China's already fast approaching that point.
Great. We're reaching key theme number three, which is all about proofing cities for climate change. So climate change and cities are deeply connected, and cities consume most of the world's energy and produce more than 60% of greenhouse gas emissions. Cities are also very vulnerable to the inevitable impacts of climate change. Accelerated investment in so-called green capex is therefore needed to future-proof our cities. Pauline, does accelerated investment in those green capex mean that we are at the start of a multi-year industrial growth cycle?
Simple terms, yes. I think it's dual-pronged. So you're seeing this with these huge proposed infrastructure spending bills, which are coming out of, you know, firstly under the Biden administration in the US, as well as in Europe. And at the heart of those is really this green capital investment. So as we've mentioned, you have this energy transition theme, and that green capital investment is not only going to go into power grids, it's going to go into supporting the electric vehicles, which we're all going to be driving, support you making buildings within cities much more energy efficient, and electrifying them, helping businesses in their transition. But at the same time, we've obviously got to limit the impact of climate change, but at the same time, sadly, we're already on the way. So we've hit 1.1 degree warming. We're fast approaching 1.5. We're already seeing this year from flooding across Europe, here in London, we've been hit, to record heat temperatures in India and Canada, droughts, water shortages. This is a crisis, and we're in the midst of it now. And so it's not only the green capital investment, it's also future-proofing our cities, getting them ready to deal with what's going to be a tough ride. It's going to make COVID look like fun, sadly. And so this is, again, going to be a huge amount of investment in protecting our cities, upgrading infrastructure to protect from flooding. And so, yeah, this in turn, we think, is going to drive what we sort of allude to, a multi-year industrial capital investment growth cycle.
Right. So when we translate that into your global sustainable outcomes strategy, where do you see the investment opportunities?
So as it's meant, you know, on the green capital investment side, we're playing across all those areas. So it's that decarbonization of power, the electric vehicles, as we've mentioned. On the industrial side, it's, you know, construction, buildings. There we've got, for example, design software companies helping that sector. You know, energy, material companies helping with that. And then on the building side, there are great opportunities and businesses helping to make buildings more sustainable. Sadly, the most impactful part of climate change is going to have the biggest health consequences and economic consequences is the heat and the results of that. So it's about trying to keep cities cool. We have a lot of concrete and it's going to be intensified. So we're going to need more cooling systems to try and keep our populations healthy and protect them. At the same time, cooling systems in turn contribute. They have carbon emissions. So you want the most sustainable solutions. So an example of a stock there is we have Train Technologies who are trying to address that challenge. They've introduced this gigaton challenge where they're aiming to remove 1 billion metric tons of greenhouse gas emissions from their customer base by 2030. Whilst meeting that rising demand, which is a fantastic, you know, the innovation there is fantastic. We're also going to face rising global water scarcity. And this is a combination of climate change, but also population growth. So it's estimated that 30% of the world's population is going to live in areas without adequate water supply by 2025. That's a scary stat. And so we really need to deal with this. And this is a dual challenge. We have to upgrade our water infrastructure. Globally, we lose 34% of water from leakages. That's a terrible stat. So it's about upgrading that. It's also investing in infrastructure to better recycle our wastewater. And so we have stock examples there that we're invested in who are providing great solutions. Xylem being one, which is a US company, but also Ecolab, who are providing business solutions to their corporate customers to help them become more water efficient.
Thank you so much, Pauline. We're now moving to the fourth theme, actually, of today's interview, which is going to be all about biodiversity. And actually, addressing biodiversity is just as pressing as tackling CO2 emissions. And we're talking real money here. According to Global Futures Initiative, trillions of euros will be wiped off the world's economies unless we reverse that nature loss. And biodiversity is the next environmental mega theme. It can generate billions of dollars of investment opportunities, if I'm correct, Natasha.
Yes, no, you're exactly correct. It's potentially a huge opportunity. It's estimated that we're still underspending by around $700 billion every year if we want to reverse biodiversity declines by 2030. And so just to put that in context, it's not an insurmountable number. It's about 1% of global GDP. But to fill that gap will require significant capital investment, which in turn will create investment opportunities for us.
Now, given the complexity of the theme, could you quantify the risks stemming from biodiversity loss and destruction of natural ecosystems, Natasha?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I think the really scary stat here is that $44 trillion, which is more than half of global GDP every single year, is moderately to highly dependent on nature and nature services. So if you put it another way, without biodiversity, we couldn't produce over half of what we produce now. And nature often gives us these services for free. We don't attribute any cost to it. It might help if we break down that $44 trillion further to maybe a more relatable example, and it would help bring it to life. I'm sure, like me, some of your listeners have been responding to calls to make our gardens more bee-friendly. So I've been busy planting lavender in my garden over the last few years, although for some reason my plants don't seem to make it. I need to replant them every year. I'm sure your listeners have better luck than me. But gardening failures aside, the message is that we depend on these pollinators if we lost them, and that's not just the bees, but all kinds of insects, annual agricultural output could drop by $217 billion. And that's before we've even costed the social impact of higher food prices. You also mentioned the complexity of this theme, and I just want to quickly touch upon this point. Biodiversity, unlike carbon, has many different measures, and a lot of them are very local to each area. So measuring marshland, for example, is very different to measuring tropical rainforests. And we're still relatively early on in developing global frameworks that can help measure and more standardize this reporting and improve disclosure. So one promising effort is the TNFD, the Task Force on Nature-Related Data, which will potentially help address this and will build on the success of the equivalent climate one. But speaking more broadly, like biodiversity is an ESG area that highlights why our engagement as investors with companies is just so important. We're questioning and listening to what the companies are doing on this area, especially in their supply chains, where, like for scope three, for carbon emissions, their operations potentially can have a large impact on biodiversity.
Mm. Now, listed companies with a primary focus on biodiversity conservation do not exist, in my understanding. So how do you then target companies that do contribute to the restoration of ecosystems, Natasha?
Yes, so a key theme that we play with in our portfolios is sustainable resource management, which targets the UN Sustainable Development Goal number 12 on responsible consumption and production. And really at its heart, it's about protecting our planet's resources and managing them in a way that does not overexploit what nature essentially has given us for free. So here we hold Deere and Trimble, two companies in the US, and both are plays on sustainable agriculture and precision farming technology, which are both vital for improving farm yields. So essentially, we need to produce more with the land that we already use. But it's not just the yield part that's important here. It's the precision agriculture part, which reduces the use of pesticides and fertilizers, just spraying on where it's needed. And this in turn reduces the impact on biodiversity. We also have another interesting holding, which is Croda. It is a UK-based specialty chemicals business. And we hear the word chemicals and we think of horrible things extracted unsustainably from fossil fuels. But Croda's focus is on biosustainability. So for them, 61% of their raw materials that they use to produce their products are from renewable, natural or bio-based sources. And they want to move that 61% up to 70 to 80%. But at the same time, they're also conscious that requiring more of this bio-based raw material is going to be land intensive. And so that's why they've announced what they term a land positive target by 2030, which means that through their innovative seed and crop products that they also sell, they're going to be able to save more land than they will use to grow their own raw materials. So net-net, there's no additional land needed, which is another important step in giving land space back to help preserve biodiversity. Maybe just one quick final example, if I may, is Mercari. This is a Japanese company that helps consumers sell and buy secondhand goods, and clothing is their biggest category that they sell. And this is important because pollution really does impact on biodiversity, and the textile industry is one of the most polluting industries, as well as being very water and land intensive. So by giving consumers and merchants a channel to create a more circular economy, this is going to be very important in helping to reuse what we've already produced and also help reduce waste.
Thank you so much, Natasha. Both of you, Pauline and Natasha, we're reaching the end of this interview already. We've been discussing four key themes when it comes to climate change. If you were to give our listeners one key message about investing in climate change, what would it be? And I'd like to ask both of you. Maybe Pauline, you'd like to go first?
We're already there. It started. We've just got to limit the impacts of this. And you as an investor, it's been shown that by shifting your pension to more sustainable investment products, that can be the biggest impact you can have in helping to address climate change. And so we really believe that it is important from an investment perspective that we change the narrative and where we are investing.
Thanks, Pauline. Anything you wish to add there, Natasha?
No, I would fully agree with Pauline that there are things that we can do in our day-to-day lives, but where we channel our finances is going to be equally as important. And not only that, is that we can also make you very good returns as well.
Wonderful. You just wanted to get that in there.
Of course.
That's great. Thanks to both of you. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Great. Thanks very much. Thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you.
You've listened to a podcast about four key climate change themes. It was offered to you by Columbia Threadneedle Investments. And I would like to thank today's guests, Pauline Grange and Natasha Abdahaj, for sharing their time and expertise. And thank you for listening. For more podcasts, please visit the Fonds News website, fondsnews.nl/podcast.
Important information for use by professional and or qualified investors only, not to be used with or passed on to retail clients. Past performance is not a guide to future performance. Your capital is at risk. The value of investments and any income is not guaranteed and can go down as well as up and may be affected by exchange rate fluctuations. This means that an investor may not get back the amount invested. This document is not investment, legal, tax, or accounting advice. Investors should consult with their own professional advisors for advice on any investment, legal, tax, or accounting issues relating to an investment with Colombian Tribunal Investments. The analysis included in this document has been produced by Colombia Tribunal Investments for its own investment management activities, may have been acted upon prior to publications, and is made available here incidentally. Any opinions expressed are made as at the date of publication but are subject to change without notice and should not be seen as investment advice. This document includes forward-looking statements, including projections of future economic and financial conditions. None of Colombia Tribunal Investments, its directors, officers, or employees make any representation, warranty, guarantee, or other assurance that any of these forward-looking statements will prove to be accurate. Information obtained from external sources is believed to be reliable, but its accuracy or completeness cannot be guaranteed. Issued by the Threadneedle Management Luxembourg SA, registered with the Registre de Commerce et de Société, Luxembourg, registered number B110242, 44 Rue de Valais, L2661, Luxembourg, Grand Duchy of Luxembourg. Colombian Threadneedle Investment is the global brand name of the Colombian and Threadneedle Group of Companies.